We invite you to visit Maserati Jacksonville today for a personalized luxury driving experience like no other. Plus, for a limited time, take advantage of our historically low interest rates. Visit online at MaseratiJacksonville.com.
Hey, welcome in. Glad you're along for the ride on a midweek edition of the program brought to you by the Kitchen and Flooring Design Center. Frank Frangie along with Hayes Carline and Lauren Brooks as we get set to embark on another Wednesday of Florida-Georgia week. Love it. Love it. Love Florida-Georgia week. Love it. I'm sorry I won't be here, but you know what, Lauren, we were down at the stadium today. You could kind of feel it a little bit. Kind of, if you sniffed a little bit, you could kind of sniff Florida-Georgia, couldn't you?
Yeah, it was fun being down at TIAA Bank Field. They were lining the field, but they had the video boards ready to go. Although I had to take a little bit of umbrage to the fact that they had the score, Georgia 8, Florida nothing, up there on the ribbon.
You weren't happy about that at all.
No, on the LCD ribbon boards when we were there. That's not what I wanted to see. But yeah, many thanks to Jaguars PR, especially Alex Brooks, for letting us go down there. And on Friday, everyone will get to see why we were down at the stadium today.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun, Lauren's Lane. Hayes Carline, Hayes, how many Florida-Georgia games have you attended? I've asked you that before. What's the number?
Attended probably 18.
18, okay. Half as a fan, or more media?
More media than fan. I probably have gone as a fan five times, okay. I would say. And I covered it every year from like 2000 to probably 2012, I think was my last one. So I had a streak of about 13, which is a baby streak compared to my media brethren. I totally understand that. But yeah, so between covering and fan, I've probably been to 18.
How about you? What is your total number?
I want to say it's probably around the same as Hayes, probably around 18, but I've never been as a media member. So the memories are more based off of photographs.
Blurry? More blurry?
A little blurry.
I get a blurry. You know, blurry? A good way to watch Florida Georgia is blurry.
Yeah, there's one time I remember we took a shot of bourbon and then someone handed me a baby and I was like, this is a bad idea.
Bourbon and a baby.
A really bad idea.
That is a tough combination, bourbon and a baby.
I don't want to get bourbon on your baby. Take your baby back. But yeah, Florida Georgia tailgating is like nothing else. I know, you know, since y'all have been as media people, you don't necessarily get to do it as often, but there's nothing like it.
Yeah, I've done my share. But more recently as a media member. Gibby, you ever been to Florida, Georgia?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been four or five times, probably.
Oh, you have? Okay. Yeah. So you've been plenty. Okay.
Yeah.
You've seen it. Media member watching?
Mostly as a fan. I've been a couple times as media, but I've got friends around here that want to go and say, hey, let's go. And so we've been four or five times.
Ah, very cool. Very cool. Gibby, I didn't watch the baseball last night. How'd the Braves do?
You didn't watch? How could you not watch?
Didn't it start last night?
It did. It started off in a big way, actually.
How'd the Braves do?
We did pretty well. We were able to, guess what? Atlanta Sports was able to hold on to a lead and not collapse and choke in a game. Duval got on the board for you, Frank.
Almost got on the board in the first, by the way. Yes. He hit one down the right field line. I thought he went oppo in the first inning, Gibb.
If you believe that Frank didn't watch last night, then I've got some oceanfront property in Arizona for you for sale.
I only watched about every pitch.
It's funny that at the end of yesterday when we were making our picks for this home run contest, we mentioned Jorge Soler's name at the end. He was on my list, but I picked Freddie and a couple and Rosario and Alvarez before him. But I'm telling you, that guy, he didn't play in the NLCS because of COVID.
Right.
And he literally came out swinging.
The reason I didn't have Soler or Rosario on my list is when they go back to Atlanta, are they both playing? You could play them both with the DH. You know the team better than I do, but there's only with the pitcher batting, there's only eight spots. They can't both start, right?
No, it's going to be an interesting situation for Brian Snitker to figure out because they've had Rosario bat lead off a couple times, many times, okay. And now that last night they batted Rosario lead off. So, and then you've got, of course, Jock Peterson involved as well. So, look, in the American League stadiums, it's a great situation, but you're going to have to put somebody on the bench.
All right, give me your starting outfield first game in Atlanta Friday night. Give me your starting outfield. Off top of your head, without knowing who's pitching for Houston, what do you think?
Starting outfield, I'm going Soler. I'm going Rosario, Duval. I got to figure out how to put them in there somewhere.
Okay, so Soler, Rosario, Duval.
Yes.
So Jock Peterson won't play in the game.
He's coming off the bench for me.
Yes, that's. I wasn't sure what to do with those three guys. I know Duval's playing every game, but those other three, I wasn't sure how they would play it. So I'm trying to avoid losing money. I'm trying to avoid buying Lauren Brooks lunch. Okay, so
right now you sit in the catbird seat.
That's why I stayed away from those guys. So I was going to play. One thing I was darn sure going to do is play guys I know we're playing.
The thing with Jock, he's probably for me. Look, I love to have him in the lineup at any time, but it's really lefty righty situation. He's a lefty, so I'm probably putting him in. You know, in a pinch hit situation.
So Rosario plays all the time.
Yeah.
And Peterson and Soler platoon. Is that your guess?
That's right.
That'd be my guess.
And I can't take Rosario out of the game right now.
I agree. So I would guess Rosario plays left field the whole time. Duvall plays center field the whole time.
Yep.
And Soler and Peterson platoon in right.
Correct.
Based on righty lefty. But I wasn't sure how they would play that though. Hayes, Adam Duvall left the yard. I know you probably were locked in last night. I'm up one on all you guys. I guess you probably know that by now.
Yeah, I do. And it's early, so I'm not incredibly nervous yet. Bregman's at-bats were terrible, but that was a good thing. I mean, I want to see my hope is that Austin Riley does enough damage for me to finish third and that I get nothing out of Tucker or Bregman because that would be best case scenario for the Braves. So, I think Atlanta showed a lot last night to lose, you know, Charlie Morton in the third inning and come right in and not allow that to become, you know, the opening to a big rally for Houston. I thought was outstanding baseball.
Yeah, the mentor guy was so good, and it was, and really not just the numbers. I mean, if Dansby Swanson, who's very good defensively, doesn't boot the one ball, they don't score, you know. So I off him. So I mean, it was give the Braves credit, man. I told you, I said Braves in six. I'll stand by that. I think the Braves have the best team in baseball right now. The team playing the best in baseball right now is the Atlanta Braves. Tonight's a really critical game, Gibby. Really critical because if you're the Astros. The Braves have already stolen home field by winning last night.
That's right.
You lose tonight, there's no way you come back. There's the 20 of the last 23 World Series champions won opening night. Did you realize that?
No, I didn't. I can see it.
20 of the last 23 won the first game, World Series champions. So that first game is really cool.
Well, they need Max Fried to go 6 or 7 tonight because the bullpen got a little bit taxed last night with Morton being hurt. So they got to have 6 or 7 out of Fried.
A lot of stuff to talk about today on the program. We talked all about Florida, Georgia. We'll continue. My friend Shane Matthews will join me at 4 o'clock today. Lauren and I will have the State Farm College Football Report at 5:15. So far more Florida, Georgia talk as we've done all week long. Shane Matthews, by the way, I'll say this. Hayes, if you think about greatest players ever in the series, like ever, the greatest players ever play in the series, Herschel is probably first because I think he averaged around 200 yards, right? I think Herschel actually averaged 200. Think about that for a second.
Correct.
I think he averaged 200 yards a game and 3 wins. Danny Werfel's up there, obviously. Shane Matthews was 3-0 against a Georgia team that had beaten Florida like 8 of the last 10 years before, and 3 in a row before he got there. He was 3-0, 11 touchdowns, 0 interceptions. You realize that? 11-0.
Yeah, it's incredible. The other thing I would say about Shane is you look at what Florida did offensively, and obviously Steve Spurrier, but you look at what Florida did offensively against Georgia in the 87, 88, and 89 games. They combined to score 23 points.
How about that?
In those 3 losses. Shane Matthews, Steve Spurrier arrive. Florida scores 38 in the 90 game, 45 in 91, and then wins 92, the 92 contest, 26-24, upsetting 7th-ranked Georgia. So 38, 45, and 26 points for Shane Matthews as a starter, just sensational.
In the 92 game, Georgia had the better team. Shane just beat him.
Right.
Shane was just that good that day. So Shane Matthews at 4.
Yeah, that was 20-7 that day.
Yeah,
Gators over dogs.
That's exactly right. So we'll certainly talk about that. But we've talked so much about that. We got to go to break, but I want to get to this later on in the program. Florida State Clemson's a nice game all of a sudden. And we have, and unfortunately, and I feel bad for my Noel friends, on Florida Georgia weekend, no matter who FSU's playing, you don't get the attention you normally would because it's Florida Georgia weekend and there's Jags and everything else. But FSU Clemson, boy, could that be the ultimate statement game for FSU. That I don't care how down Clemson is, it's still Clemson, and it's still a road game. That could be the ultimate we've arrived game. I thought the Notre Dame close call was a we've arrived game. Now, You can't play. You can't barely lose, and it's a We Are Arrived game. You'd have to win the game, but we'll certainly talk about the importance.
Don't forget the bitterness that was the FSU-Clemson non-game a season ago.
That's a great call. So that angst is still out there, so a lot to talk about on the program. We'll take a break, but we've got coming up today our Duval County Scholar Athlete of the Week. That's at 3:40. Shane checks in at 4 o'clock. We're going to try and check in on the women's professional match play, which I think is a really cool event that's going on at the King of the Bear this weekend. And it's a cool stuff. So we're going to tell you a little bit about that coming up on the program as well. So we got a lot of stuff. We're glad you're with us. Frank Frangie, Hayes Carline, Lauren Brooks, Andrew Gibson. Let's kick it off with some Jaguar talk. The trade deadline is right around the corner. Do the Jags make a move? Should they make a move? That's our topic after this.
I know we meet on it every day. We already met on it today, so the phone's buzzing. I don't know all that yet, but I know if there's a chance to make us better, we listen.
Hey, we're glad you're with us on a Wednesday. Thanks to our friends at the Kitchen Flooring Design Center. Renee and his team do a terrific job. Been our sponsors on Wednesday for a long time. They've redone our kitchens and bathrooms. They've redone the inside of Lauren's home. We trust them around here, the Kitchen Flooring Design Center. Frank Frangie, Lauren Brooks, Hayes Carline with you. Let's talk a little Jags. We got a lot of stuff to get to today. Duval County Scholar Athlete coming up at 3:40. Shane Matthews joins me at 4 o'clock to talk Florida-Georgia. The State Farm College Football Report is in the 5 o'clock hour. We'll check in with the women's match play, which is a terrific event here on the First Coast in the 4 o'clock hour as well. Hayes, too early to be thinking trade deadline. I say too early. Not too early in the year, but too early in the rebuild of the team, if you will. Can it be meaningful at all for the Jaguars or not this year?
I wouldn't think, because with the record, you'd be more selling than buying. And at this point, you know, the players that might have some value, Cam Robinson, who's, you know, based, you know, on playing on the franchise tag, very questionable whether he'll be a part of this team next year. You know, that would make some sense. But do you want to give away, you know, one of the few remaining healthy linemen that you have? And I don't think you do. So, you know, you hope that if you can't get something done with Cam Robinson, and I wouldn't think they'd franchise tag him again, then he'll at least get a big enough contract that you'll get a comp pick somewhere down the road, maybe. But I don't think you want to do that to Trevor Lawrence right now when you're already down Linder and you're already down AJ Can. So the two pieces that I think could generate the most in terms of selling would be Cam Robinson and Andrew Norwell. But I just don't think it makes a lot of sense to do it and put Trevor Lawrence's health in jeopardy. They're doing a nice job of protecting him right now. They're doing a nice job running the ball. I wouldn't want to see that get disrupted. So I don't think they can be sellers really, and not jeopardize Trevor Lawrence. And there's really no point in buying it at this stage. They do have 4 6-round picks, which has sort of become the sweet spot, you know, for acquiring a veteran. But I'm the only one that I'd be somewhat interested in talking about, and this would involve more than a 6-round pick, would be Michael Thomas from New Orleans. I'm still very intrigued by adding him. But I also have to wonder, if he's not back yet, how close is he to coming back? And is he a player that, you know, perhaps you can get a better deal this offseason than having to give up something right now? So Michael Thomas is a conversation I'd like the Jaguars to have, at least in the preliminary fashion. But everything else, I don't really see anything that makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, if they wanted to trade a 6-rounder to the Colts for a running back like Marlon Mack, somebody that can, you know, catch the football, I certainly would understand that. But it doesn't seem to line up well to me for the Jaguars to be very active.
Yeah, I think Hayes makes good points. There's no way I'm trading Cam Robinson. I guess Norwell, it would depend on what teams are willing to offer. But no, I really don't think I'd trade either of them. Trevor Lawrence has to be protected at all costs. And I do think this team, call me crazy, Frank, but I feel like this team shouldn't really be interested in buying or selling right now. I think they're a little bit closer than maybe we thought as far as building a core to potentially be a perennial playoff team because of how good Trevor Lawrence has been. So I wouldn't really be interested in selling that much. And then obviously they're not going to make the playoffs this year, so I wouldn't be interested in buying unless, yeah, you could get a wide receiver like Michael Thomas.
I think you guys have kind of hit it. I don't think you sell. Right now, the fan base is excited about what it looks like you're starting to build. To your point, Lauren, they're excited, and to your point too, Hayes, about protecting Trevor. If a guy you're thinking about selling is Cam Robinson, but he's on an expiring deal anyway. So for me, I don't think there's any way you sell. I think you've gone too hard. You're trying too hard to accumulate whatever wins you can. It isn't worth the low round pick you'd get to sacrifice what could be a win this year. I think wins this year do matter, even if you're not going anywhere in the postseason. So I definitely wouldn't sell. I think without question, I wouldn't sell. Buying Hayes, you might have hit where I was going to go with this. Someone asked me the other day, what are the real, as you see this team right now, what are your biggest concerns? Well, biggest concern right now for me, there's two. Offensively, you got to stretch the field vertically. I don't know who's there to do that. They certainly want Jamal Agnew to do that, and he's certainly a wonderful player and runs really fast, and if he learns the position, maybe he can do it. But with DJ Chark out, how do you stretch the field and open up running lanes for James Robinson and even underneath passing areas for Laviska Shenault, who seems to he can work that middle pretty well now, but how do you open up that area by at least clearing out to a point? The second area of concern I would have about this football team is, okay, if you're not a coverage team, if you're not a team that can, if Urban Meyer's pretty much said, listen, we got to play zone. We weren't great in man coverage. Well, that means you sit back and you keep everything underneath. That means you don't blitz as much, so you got to get home. If you don't get home and you're playing zone, the middle of the field's wide open, and Miami wore them out in the middle of the field. Didn't beat them, but wore them out. So the other area is how do you cover if you can't get home, and how do you stretch the field vertically? Well, I don't think you can solve the defensive problem by trading a sixth-round pick. I don't think there's anybody out there. Pass rushers aren't available because they're hard to come by. I don't think a linebacker helps you that much. So I don't know that you can solve that one. But, Hayes, the one thing I thought about is, can you go find a receiver who can stretch the field for you? I don't think it's a Michael Thomas because I agree with you. I don't think you're ready to make that move right now. I don't think he's a guy that would be happy with that move, if at all. But do you find a young receiver, someone who's better than what Tyron Johnson is, better than what Tavon Austin is? Look, they've really been trying to find fast receivers ever since, even before Chark got hurt. But they don't go pick up Tyron Johnson and Tavon Austin and talk about using Jamal Agnew at receiver if they're not trying to find some speed out wide. They're clearly trying to find speed out there. So Hayes is, and I don't know who it would be, but is there somebody's third or fourth receiver that isn't breaking into the first two or three on that team because that team's got a lot of really good receivers, but can stretch the field for you in a way that changes you a little bit, that helps the development of Trevor Lawrence? So I would say that, Hayes. I would say if there's one thing, if I could find a young receiver who's fast, if he's a really accomplished receiver, he's not going to be available. I get that. But a young, fast guy who you can develop and maybe can take the top off the defense once or twice a game, if there's anything at all in the trade deadline for me, that's what it would be.
And that would be the dream scenario, but I don't think that exists because you're looking at the guys at the receiver position that, you know, you're seeing being sort of talked about, or more possession guys, more slot guys that aren't burners. I think it's just going to be difficult because, I mean, again, the trade deadline normally comes and goes without a whole lot of activity anyway, because, you know, the players that you're kind of talking about would probably be on rookie contracts, so they're affordable. There's not a lot of motivation to trade them. You know, you want to keep developing them. You know, injuries can happen. You know, the Jaguars still have 11 games left. You know, there's some teams that, you know, have even more. So, I mean, it's when you look at it, I think it's hard to get that to fit, because of what we've talked about a while, which is if you can, you know, if you've got a player that can separate, you know, teams aren't right. likely to part with the player. That's why we were so surprised when Tyron Johnson was released. Now, he hasn't done anything as a Jaguar, but it was part of the reason why, because you just don't normally see guys that can get behind the defense and score be available. So that would be awesome if it's there, but I don't think there's a legitimate candidate, unfortunately, that can fill that for the Jaguars.
Yeah, and again, I agree with you, by the way. I'm saying if they did anything at all, that would be it. And I don't think it's Michael Thomas or Brandon Cooks or Odell Beckham Jr. or the three guys that people are talking about might get traded. It's not one of those guys. It's not a guy that far along in his career. It's a guy that might be what you were hoping Tyron Johnson was. Clearly, They were very excited about picking him up. The Chargers, there's members of the Charger media base, the media group, that thought the Chargers made a mistake by making him available and weren't surprised he got snapped up so quickly. The minute it happened, or not the minute it happened, but shortly after, it was clear he wasn't in the plans for the Jags, not yet. By the way, I've talked to people. They weren't wrong about the speed, Hayes. They weren't wrong. He can run now. He's just obviously not ready. They got to find someone. So, Lauren, my point was, is there a fast guy that's more ready than Tyron Johnson apparently is, but is young enough that he hasn't done much that he could change the speed of the offense? I don't know if that guy's out there either.
Yeah, I would say that the Jaguars are probably most likely going to have to draft a guy like that unless they end up signing a guy. I don't think that they'll be available just because teams are going to hold on to those guys because look at what happens. I mean, usually you don't have depth at a position like that, and that's obviously what happened with the Jags, like you mentioned with DJ Chark out.
I will say this. I think they have a good in-house solution in Jamal Agnew. I think Agnew is a player that needs to be developed over these 11 games to see what you have with Jamal Agnew, because I don't think it can be ruled out that he can be a part of the receiving core in 2022, not as a guy that, oh yeah, and he's the returner,
right?
But as a guy that can be an actual player at that position and a big time contributor. I mean, he has still so much upside because he just hasn't played receiver all that long. Urban Meyer is saying he's the best separator right now on the team. I mean, to me, if I was the Jaguars, find out what you have in Jamal Agnew, who you have under contract for another few years. See what you have there. Because to me, I think Jamal Agnew, the in-house solution, and we rarely say this with the Jaguars, but I think in this case it applies, the in-house solution I think is better than going on the outside and trying to solve the problem through a trade or waivers or something like that.
Well, I don't think there's any question they're going to do that. Regardless of what, and again, I don't think they're doing anything at the deadline either. I'm not trying to create a story that I don't think is there. I'm just for the sake of conversation. If there was anything they were going to do realistically, that would be it. Go trade a sixth or seventh round pick for a Tyron Johnson who runs like him, who's young like him, who's maybe a little more ready than him. But other than that, I don't think they're going to make a move. But I think they're going to do what you just said. I think they've pretty much made it clear. They're going to see what they've got in Jamal Agnew as a receiver. I think what they've said, what Urban said at his press conferences, the plays they've called, we've already seen him on jet sweeps. We've already seen him on more pass routes than we thought we were going to all year long. So I think they're going to do that. Is there any way you can add to it? But I agree with you. I think probably the trade deadline will come and go. I think what we've all agreed is you don't sell. You don't sell here. You don't sell now. No, you don't. That's probably.
Yeah, the only way I could see it, Frank, is if there's a guy in the locker room that they feel like is a bad apple who's not meshing culture-wise.
I agree.
That's the only way I can see that.
Totally agree. If there's a guy you want to run off, but I'll give him credit. The one thing Urban Meyer has said from day one is there's none of that here. Mm-hmm. Not now, anyway. Today, it's a pretty good locker room. That it's a lot of guys pulling in the same direction. I do believe that. I just being around them as I have, being around people that are around them. I do think that they've accomplished. I think they have. So we'll see.
I will say this. I would be willing to have a conversation about Taven Bryan, but it will require two ones and two twos.
Well, and I think you probably could get that. I don't think there's any question.
But Hazy's so strong and powerful. Why would you let that go?
That's a very good point.
And two twos. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll say hello to our Duval County Scholar Athlete of the Week. That and more we continue. It's 1010 XL and 92.5 FM.
And now, this week's Scholar Athlete of the Week, brought to you by Southeast Orthopedic Specialists and the Plumbers and Pipefitters Local Union 234 on 1010XL.
And we welcome in Colton Goff, a senior at Stanton. You play both football and varsity lacrosse. Thanks so much for joining us and congratulations, Colton.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. All right, you came in here wearing a Jaguars hat and you have long blonde hair. So my first question to you, are you going as Trevor Lawrence for Halloween?
I could. I wanted to. I get that a lot, actually.
And is he your favorite Jaguar?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, that's a good answer.
I mean, I can see. I mean, you kind of look like Trevor. I can see why. I mean,
yeah.
Lauren's not kidding. He kind of looked like Trevor. We'll tweet a picture out so you can see that he looks like
Trevor.
Sure,
but you don't play quarterback.
No, I do not play quarterback, no.
But you are on the offense.
Yes, ma'am.
How long have you been playing football?
I've been playing football since I was about 10 years old.
Okay.
So tell us about football. We'll get to lacrosse in a second, but why football? Where'd you play? Pop Warner, tell us all about that.
Well, I started playing football when I was about 10 years old for Ponte Vedra football, and I played center there, but they actually had to move me up an age group because I was so big when I was younger, so that was fun.
Right.
So going against guys that were older than me, that, I think, toughened me up. But then when I got into high school, I started playing tight end because I wasn't the biggest guy on the field anymore,
right.
And now I play tight end and wide receiver.
I got you. Very, very cool stuff. And tell us about lacrosse. Tell us about how long you've played lacrosse and why lacrosse.
Well, I played lacrosse for 6 years now. I play defense for lacrosse. I really got into lacrosse because my older brother, Chad, he actually played lacrosse at Stanton, and I wear the same number as him, play the same position as him. So he's a big inspiration for me for lacrosse and why I started playing that sport.
Oh, very cool.
Is it hard to play two sports and keep up really good grades?
I actually feel like I do better during season than off season because it kind of keeps me focused, and you really have to manage your time well to get everything done.
You have too much time on your hands in the off season.
True.
Well, look, you're at a really good academic school, and you make really good grades and have great test scores. Obviously, you're a really good student. What are your plans? What do you want to do? Number one, I see you've applied to Florida.
Yes, sir.
Right. So, tell us about that. How that process will go, and what do you want to study?
So, hopefully, when I get into Florida, I'll become a business major and segue into law school and become a corporate lawyer because I've always wanted to become a lawyer because I feel like I feel like I'm good at arguing and
yeah.
I usually win.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
I like to be right.
You know what? There you go. And so you want to study law wherever you go. That's very cool. Now, are there other schools you're going to apply to, or seeing your grades and your test scores, you probably get in wherever you apply to. So you may not need to go to a second school, but you're pretty much locked in on Florida.
Yes, sir.
Very cool.
That's what I did, by the way, in high school. My guidance counselor told me that I had to apply to more than one school. And mm-hmm. I said, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm only applying to one school. And luckily for me, I got in. So I think you will too, Colton. Final question. You're a part of the National Chinese Honor Society. Tell us about that.
So in middle school, at my middle school, they made all the kids in my track go into Chinese. And I've been doing Spanish for 4 or 5 years before. And I really liked Chinese a lot better. So I've
really?
Been doing Chinese. I did it for 6 years. I'm not doing it this year, but I did finish the course already. So that was really fun to learn a unique language like that.
That really is cool because I don't think we know anybody that has done
no,
that.
No, can you speak or write it now?
Sparingly.
Okay. So yeah, sure.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
By the way,
say it confidently. Absolutely.
We wouldn't know either way.
Right, exactly.
So, but, all right, Colton Goff is our Duval County Scholar Athlete of the Week from Stanton. Terrific student, football and lacrosse player. Hey, thanks for stopping by. Congratulations, man.
Thanks so much.
All right, Colton Goff is from Stanton Prep. He is our Duval County Scholar Athlete of the Week. Terrific student and, I mean, really good grades, really good test scores. What I like best is the confidence. I'm applying to Florida. I'm applying to Florida.
I completely understand that. You gotta have the confidence.
Was that the only school you applied to?
It was, yes. Now, I did apply for summer because obviously more people try to get in fall. And so just to be on the safe side, I think my grades were good enough that I could have gotten in for fall. But you know me well enough to know, Frank, that I'm very directionally challenged.
Yeah.
So it was a very good idea. And my parents encouraged me to go in the summertime before there were 50,000 people on campus and kind of learn my way around. Even though I've been going to Gainesville since I was little, I didn't know, you know, exactly where a lot of the buildings were. So I learned my way around in the summer, and then by the time everybody else got there, I was a seasoned veteran.
Hayes, how many schools – Hayes started at Florida. How many schools did you apply to?
I only applied to one school because I was really good friends with Lori Loughlin, and she guaranteed that I'd get into Florida. So that was the only one I applied to.
That's awesome, and God bless Lori. It's always a better show when Lori makes the program.
She was innocent, by the way.
Yeah, she was
completely
innocent. Biggest scam of all time. With that appeal, will yield big dollars, is what I think. Big dollars.
Yes.
I only applied to one school too. And I can tell you, there's no chance they were keeping me out. That doggone 3.0 grade point average and 895 SAT. That was a junior college transfer they had to have. That's what I'm just being honest. That's what happened. They had to have me. Back. Do you still have to take the JUCO graduates?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I would assume that it's the same way.
Yeah.
Because so many of the freshmen and the underclassmen end up leaving.
Back then, if you had an associate degree from a state junior college, they had to take you. Sorry, Florida. Hey, you don't have to like the 895 SAT. You had to take me.
Well, I knew a lot of kids that went to Santa Fe and then automatically got into Florida. And so, you know, I think some parents, though, Frank, were more like your parent. Like, no, no, if you're going to junior college, you're going to stay in town. Yep. And then when you go to Florida, you can leave.
And there wasn't much debate about where I was going to go. The rent was free. The rent at home was free. Hey, I mentioned this at the top of the program, Florida State, Clemson. Can the Noles beat Clemson? Can they win that game?
The Noles are going to beat Clemson.
You think they're going to win?
Yeah, I don't understand why this is a 10-point line in Clemson's favor, other than the fact that it's at Clemson. Clemson cannot score. They cannot score on anybody. I mean, they've barely scored 17 or more points in any of these games. They scored 21 against NC State. The game went to double overtime. They have one game where they scored 49 points. I believe it was against South Carolina State. But if you look at what Clemson's offense has done in ACC play, they are putrid. And I can't imagine that Jordan Travis isn't going to get loose a couple times, and that Corbin isn't going to get loose a couple times. This game really, to me, makes no sense. Clemson doesn't know who its quarterback is. They have no confidence. Florida State, I think, knows who its quarterback is and is playing with confidence. I think Florida State goes up to Clemson and wins.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that line of thinking. I'm not there yet. I still think that FSU as a program will get a little bit intimidated going to Clemson. And I do think eventually, at some point, Dabo Swinney will decide that DJ Uiagalelei is the starter once again. I know he benched him last week, but I think he goes back in. I think he finds some confidence. I think it's a close game, but I think in the end, Clemson pulls out the victory.
See, Clemson, I'm surprised. And in fairness, they've had so many great years. They're entitled to one off year now. I mean, in fairness.
Yeah, as long as it's only one year, that I think that's okay.
But I am surprised a little bit that they seem hazed this helpless offensively. Most teams in this day and age, there's a lot of teams, I mean middle-of-the-pack Conference USA teams, that might not be very good and don't have near the athletes that a Clemson does, but they can find a way to move the ball down the field in the passing game because every kid that comes now played in these 7-on-7s and knows the passing game, and the game is more geared than ever and the rules are more geared, and the way the games are officiated are more geared than ever to help the offense. I don't know. I'm surprised that Clemson has fallen off this badly offensively. I mean, this is Treon Harris, Jim McElwain, Florida bad offensively. I'm surprised it's that bad.
I am shocked because Clemson, you know, has good coaches. Clemson has talent, but something is not adding up. I mean, again, they only scored 3 against Georgia in the opener. Well, Georgia might have one of the best defenses in college football history, so you can forgive them for that. I then mentioned they scored 49 on South Carolina State, the cupcake. Since then, they have scored 14 against Georgia Tech, 21 against NC State, again, a game that went to double overtime that they lost, 19 against Boston College, 17 against Syracuse, and 17 against Pitt. I just don't see them scoring more than 17 on Florida State. And I think Florida State is offensively good enough now that I think they're going to score in the 20s. So I'm very intrigued. Maybe Clemson has a huge day on special teams. Maybe they win the turnover battle, +2 or something like that. But I am shocked that Clemson is a 10-point favorite in this game, because they can barely score. They shouldn't be a 10-point favorite over any school in the ACC. If this is what they're consistently doing week in and week out, and we're now deep into conference play. They've scored 88 points in 5 ACC games.
This is one game I really wish wasn't opposite Florida-Georgia. I mean, they're on the same time, and that happened. By the way, it happens a lot. If you're wondering, is it just happenstance that the Gators on CBS and the Noles on one of the ESPN stations or ABC happen to go head to head a lot? It's not happenstance. It's CBS announces its schedule well in advance, and often over the years, particularly when they're both good, ABC, ESPN, to try and compete in that region for viewers, will go head to head with another game of Florida interest. That's not an accident.
Right.
The ESPN family, wisely, by the way, will. I mean, if Georgia and Georgia Tech were both good, if CBS has the Georgia game on, if Georgia Tech was a good team that people were watching, if they're in their good years, then ABC ESPN will put Georgia Tech on 3:30 also to gain the regional viewers. So that's a kind of a common thing.
This one's ESPN.
Yeah, it is on ESPN. So, but it's a shame you got to not be able to watch both of them. And in my Seattle hotel room, if it's 31-3, I'm turning it. So then I will watch it, Hayes. 31-3 is my breaking point, Hayes. I don't know what your breaking point is. That's about mine.
My breaking point is 17-3.
Okay, that's it, huh? Well, I worry about your breaking point then, okay?
Yeah. 31-3, well, I think we might be okay. Well, particularly if it's Emory Jones, my breaking point is absolutely 17. If Richardson's playing, then I'll stick with it until it's 31-3.
I will give Dan Mullen credit for this. Why? First off, I said a week ago you should name Anthony Richardson to generate some momentum in the fan base. Okay, I generate momentum, get on the recruiting trail. But now the more I think about it, now that he hasn't, it is wise now, even though he was kind of coy today. You can tell he's annoyed. Because today, I don't know if you guys, did you guys hear the presser today? What are you going to do at quarterback? He said, we're gonna play one. He said, at all times we're on offense, we'll have a quarterback on the field. Well, now I'm being a smart aleck guy.
Yeah, that's a relief.
Yeah. Here's what that answer means. I'm now fed up with the question.
I think both coaches are in the rivalry. I think Kirby is too.
Yeah, by the way, and maybe we talked about this, Hayes, with you yesterday and Lauren. Jeff Dantzler is convinced Stetson Bennett plays. Buck Ballou, who covered the team very closely and was a star quarterback at Georgia, a legendary quarterback, is convinced they need to play JT Daniels a lion's share of the game. This is two guys that really know that program. That have kind of drawn a line in the sand and seem to be convinced what they're going to do. Hayes, does it surprise you that those two guys who you've heard on with me for many years are that opposite on what they think George is going to do?
It doesn't, because I think Kirby Smart is the one that has the real QB dilemma. Dan Mullen's the one that's created his own dilemma. I mean, he has no dilemma. It should be Richardson at quarterback, and it should have been Richardson at quarterback 3 weeks ago. He's the only one that's making that a dilemma. That's a self-destructive dilemma. What Kirby Smart has is really a problem of you've got the hot player in Stetson Bennett versus you have the more talented player in JT Daniels that just hasn't been playing. So Kirby Smart has, I think, a legitimate dilemma on what to do. And I think there's some pressure there because it can backfire either way. If he sticks with Stetson Bennett and Bennett doesn't play well and Florida gets out to a lead and Florida ultimately wins the game, then everybody is going to say, why did you play Stetson Bennett? You're five-star you. Why are you playing Stetson Bennett? Sure, he was great against these other teams, but they're not Florida. And JT Daniels, by the time you went to him, it was too late or whatever. Conversely, if he goes with JT Daniels and JT Daniels struggles, then you're going to take on a ton of criticism because you went away from the hot quarterback who is right now a big reason why Georgia is number one in the SEC in pass efficiency offense. So I don't envy what Kirby Smart has to decide, but I have no feelings of any sort of sympathy for Dan Mullen because he's the one that's dug his own hole with how he's handled his quarterbacks.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll keep it on Florida-Georgia. Shane Matthews, one of the most effective players in Florida-Georgia history. 3 straight wins, great numbers against Georgia. He joins me in a moment. By the way, he's a color commentator on the Gator Radio Network, which you hear right here on 1010XL. Lee McGriff is the full-time color commentator and has been for the longest time. But Lee wanted to take this season off and watch his grandson play football, at least for the road games. And Shane has stepped in and done a fantastic job, by the way, sitting alongside Mick Hubert. Shane Matthews joins us after this on 1010XL and 92.5 FM. Glad you're with us on a Wednesday. My friend Shane Matthews will join us momentarily, trying to track Shane down, and we'll talk a little bit about the history of the series. I was thinking about this before we had Shane on, Lauren. The people, Danny Werfel was great in this series. Okay, Danny Werfel, he won this game in 3 cities. Okay, he's won the game.
No one else can say that.
No,
right?
but I'm trying to think about this. 93 wasn't his win. In fact, he played badly in 93, and Terry Dean had to come in and win the game. So he wasn't great in 93. So he had to come in and he came got pulled out of the game,
mm-hmm.
and Terry Dean came in. So all of a sudden, he played well the next 3 games. He won in Gainesville, He won in Athens and he won in Jacksonville. But
he had a pretty good resume.
But he had a bad game. So most people, when you talk about the best that ever played here, never had a bad game. My buddy Shane Matthews joins us now from Gainesville. Shane, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing well. We were talking about this earlier. So, and I love to give you hell about stuff like this because you're kind of like shy guy. But Herschel and you, best two players ever in the series? What do you think? Think about it. Look at the numbers for a second. Right? Wrong? Is that close? How many times you've been mentioned in Herschel Walker? Same sentence, by the way. That's the same sentence for you.
Well, I was close to tying Herschel. I think he's the only SEC Player of the Year three times, if I'm not mistaken. And I had a chance to win it my third time my senior year, but things didn't work out.
Yeah, Shane was 11 touchdowns, no picks against Georgia, beat him three times, had no business winning the third game, honestly.
None.
Because they had a way better team, and Florida won all three times. Florida had scored, Hayes Carline had the stat earlier, you scored more points against them in 90 than Florida scored the last 3 years combined against them. So, yeah, so there you go. So you and Herschel in the same sentence. That's free of charge there, Shane.
I love it. Hey. I appreciate it.
Hey, tell me about this team a little bit. You and I have talked a lot offline about this, but and I'll get right to it. I'm puzzled by the Emory Jones stuff. I understood it was his turn, and he waited his turn. And I don't know how good Anthony Richardson's going to be, Shane, because we haven't seen enough of him, but I sure like what I've seen so far. But it seems to me Emory Jones is a tick slow processing. He gets the ball out of hair slow, isn't decisive. And it seems to me that Anthony Richardson is way more decisive. Now, that's what I see watching it. Do you see that? Do you think that? You're the color commentator on the game. You see him closer than anybody. What do you think about this whole quarterback thing?
No, I agree with what you're saying, but they're Dan or whoever, I guess Dan, he's in charge of the offense. They approach it differently. So, you know, I've heard you talk to, when I'm in Jacksonville, Frank, on your show about how Emory, you know, he runs up to the line of scrimmage and you hear him yelling at the offensive line. Well, what they do with Emory is they signal a play in, and then you always see Emory and the other guys look to the sideline. It's like they're trying to get the perfect play called. Whereas when Anthony's in the game, they just call a play and they run it no matter what. And I think the reason they do that is because they don't want him thinking, and he probably doesn't know all the protection changes and all that kind of stuff. And plus, if it's not a good play, they probably feel like with his athleticism, he can make it a good play, which right. He's done several times. As you know, protection breaks down, he takes off and runs for 15 yards. So that's what they've been doing. Do I think Anthony's going to be a good player? I do. He's a perfect fit for what Dan likes to do, you know, with the quarterback runs and that those type things. I don't think he's a great thrower. I think he's made some good throws. There's no question about that. But most of it is, I think this guy's going to be open, and I'm going to sling it down there. And for the most part, it's worked out really well.
So has he handicapped Emory by asking him to get into that perfect play too many times? Because you told me this the other night when we did a video cast together, and I had not heard that till you said that. Dan's a good coach. No one's criticizing how good he is, but even good coaches make mistakes. Are they asking Emory to change the play too much, to try and do too many things? Are they making it harder on him than it should be?
I mean, possibly. I think from an athletic standpoint, though, you know, I think Anthony's got more talent. I think he's a better thrower than Emory, but yeah. You know, it's a shame. I think Emory's played pretty well for the most part when you compare him to quarterbacks that we've had here in the past yeah. 10, 12 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, Anthony's the guy, like you said, what I think a lot of college coaches these days rely on. What can the guy do if protection breaks down or I call a bad play? Can he make it a positive play? And Anthony, for the most part, can do that.
You're on the charter with these guys. You're by calling the games, you're around them. I know all about that. I'm all around being around a team all the time. What is your sense? Are they all pulling in the same direction? Is there frustration for a team that expected to be better by now than they were? They've lost to two teams when they were the favored team. What's the culture? What's the feeling in that locker room, as best you can tell?
I think it's a pretty good culture for the most part. I mean, I don't think anybody's happy with losing three games at this point, and you're looking at your fourth loss. I mean, nobody ever anticipated that. But, you know, I see a team that likes one another. I don't think they're picking sides. You know, sometimes when you have a quarterback issue, team, right. you know, players pick sides. I don't see that at all. You know, I've said all week on my shows the last couple of weeks, people want to make a quarterback change. I get it. But I feel like there's more problems, not problems, but more issues elsewhere. And, you know, if you're a linebacker or a defensive end and you're getting blocked the entire game or a defensive tackle, maybe put in the next guy and see if he can get some penetration and shed a block. I think that goes a long way. I don't know what they're going to do against Georgia. We're going to have to play 1,000 times better than we did in Baton Rouge, though.
Shane Matthews with us, our guest. Nobody knows Florida football better. I'll say this. You and I talk a lot. And Shane and I talk a lot off air, so I know a lot of his feelings about this. I think you feel like, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, so correct me, but you feel like as much grief as Todd Grantham gets, and certainly got last week, that sometimes it's players not making plays, and if there's a mistake, it's playing the wrong guy, not the wrong scheme. Now, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that close to kind of what we've talked about?
Yeah, you know, I understand where the Gator Nation's upset with Todd. I totally get it. But, again, you know, as a defensive player, I think defense is all about attitude and effort. You know, you may not be a great player, but you can give me damn good effort on every play and do my job and shed blocks and try to make tackles. And a lot of times I haven't seen that out of a lot of guys, and that's why I wish they would maybe try the backup. Now, I don't know if the backup's any better.
Right.
Who knows? But, you know, maybe that guy gives us effort, and, you know, instead of it being a 35-yard gain, it's only a 10-yard gain because he gave a little bit of effort. But we did not shed blocks. We got no penetration against LSU. I was very upset at the way we played defense in that game. Having said that, the defense really only gave up 28 points in that game. I know the scoreboard said 49, but the offense gave them 21.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I know that, you know, everybody wants to talk about the quarterback position because that's who they see with the ball in their hands every play. But I feel like there's some other players that probably may need to just maybe sit on the bench a couple series and see how that feels.
Yeah, I hear you. I will tell you, and you've forgotten more football than I'll know, Shane, but I thought this is the one, and I've been a defender of Todd Grantham, but the LSU game is the one I thought he needed to find an answer and he couldn't. At some point, there's a reason nobody's ever rushed for 287 yards against Florida in the history of the program. Is at some point somebody makes an adjustment and you stack the box with eight guys, and then if on the next play they throw it over the top because you're not good man coverage, so be it. But at least you solve one problem and take on the other problem. I was very surprised that the defensive coaching staff couldn't solve the first problem. Are you with me on that? I think that's my point.
No.
They couldn't solve that problem.
I agree with that, but I also have been on a million football teams where – the head coach is the guy in charge.
Yeah.
He knows the plan. He can get on that headset at any time and say,
good point.
Blitz them. Give me an all-out cover zero blitz right now. I know the guy I played for, when a team had a methodical drive, mm-hmm. he would go up to Jim Bates or whoever the coordinator was and mm-hmm. do whatever you got to do, get me the ball back.
Yeah.
So Dan knows – I mean, and it's the same way when people get upset with the way Alabama's playing defense and they want to fire that coordinator. Well, I got news for you. The head coach runs that defense at Alabama.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's my only issue there. So, yeah, maybe the plan wasn't great, but I could not believe the effort in that game. That's what bothered me the most.
Yeah, and you said that consistently. And by the way, I agree with your point about the head coach. When the coaching staff can't stop the run, fans tend to think it's all on the coordinator. Well, the reality is there's one guy at the top. You're right about that. Even offensive-minded head coaches will get that. Will turn, you know, for people that don't know how it works, there's channels. And the head coach can flip to any channel. He can hear the defensive coaches talking. He can hear the offensive coaches talking. He can get involved and call whatever he wants. So I think that's on Mullen a little bit as well. So bottom line is it's a tough spot they're in now. So what now? What do you think they will do? Will they play? And again, I'll be honest. I would play Richardson. That's not a knock on Emory, but I think Emory's a 4-3 as a starter. We've seen the flaws. There may be flaws with Anthony, but I haven't seen him yet. What do you think they will do? How do you think Dan Mullen's been very coy, as he should be? Shane, how do you think they'll go about this?
Well, I don't think we're going to run the football in Georgia, so we're going to have to throw it a bunch.
Agreed.
I think if there's a weakness, you got to attack the secondary. I think Anthony's the guy that probably gives you the best chance of that because he's going to be able to run around, break tackles, things of that nature. But, you know, pass protection is going to be a key as well. So I honestly think you're going to see four quarterbacks play in this game. I think you're going to see from the two from Georgia and two from Florida, which is crazy when you think about it.
Yeah, Buck Ballew was on yesterday with me, and he told me he's convinced Georgia needs to go back to JT Daniels because he's better in the passing game. And I know all you quarterbacks want to see people throw the ball down the field, so he feels kind of the way you do. He's Jeff Dancer, who covers the team, thinks they should stay with Stetson Bennett. If you're Kirby Smart, what would you do?
I'm a huge Stetson Bennett guy. I loved him last year. He's a guy that he ain't going to wow you at the Elite 11s or the Combines or any of that stuff. But the dude knows how to play the position. He's got the intangibles you cannot coach. And I think people forget, Stetson Bennett had a 14-0 lead on Florida last year until he got hit and driven into the ground and hurt his shoulder. And then the tide changed. JT Daniels looked good and has a great arm and all that stuff. But if I'm Kirby Smart, I play Stetson Bennett. I think the team believes in him, and I think he's a really good player.
See, I agree with you. I would play Stetson for everything you just said. I don't know if he's a really good player, but he's certainly the perfect player for that team. I agree with that. Yeah. I would play him too, and I would play Richardson. And the other thing I would do too, and again, media guys tend to oversimplify this stuff, and football people understand it better. What I would not do is let them run Zamir White and James Cook all day long. I don't care if I've got eight in the box, and if Jason Marshall and Kair Elam can't play man coverage and they throw it over the top, so be it. I get the ball back, but they would not beat me by a death by a thousand cuts if I could help it. Do you see it that way as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously we know Georgia's got a very powerful offensive line, really good running backs. That's what they want to do, and then play action and throw it over the top. Roll the dice and do whatever you can to stop the run. And, you know, whether that's JT Daniels or Stetson Bennett, make them beat you throwing the football. And if they hit a bunch of deep balls on you, people are going to be calling the Frank Frangie show complaining about the secondary.
Yeah, that's right. No, you're right. But I'd rather have that than some dude that I've never heard of get 287, okay?
I'm with you. Yes. I'm with you. I'm just kidding.
No, you're right, though. I hear you. Hey, state of the program. If they lose the game, they're 4-4. For the first time, the fan base has their doubts about Dan Mullen. This is the first time that's happened. And again, to be clear, I don't have my doubts about him. I think he's got to clean up some stuff. I think he's got to quit being stubborn. But I think he's the right guy. I would like to see him recruit better, maybe a better recruiting staff. I know they made some changes. But you know this program, man. The state of the program, are they okay if they're 4-4? Will are people jumping off the bandwagon? How do you see that thing big picture, Shane?
Well, it's concerning. You went 8-4 last year, and could go 8-4 again this year. And, you know, I didn't think we'd be heading in that direction. And, you know, I've always been a big guy. I don't follow recruiting, but I've said, you know, we've been behind, but due to not having a football standalone facility, we're like one of the only teams in America that doesn't have one, but right. It will be finished probably, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months.
Yep.
That will help. But I just don't know what we have to do to recruit better. I don't know the answer to that. Because Frank, I mean, I could be a coach and come sit on your couch in your living room and tell you how great Florida is, this, that, and the other. But when it's all said and done, you're going to go to one of those teams that are in the hunt to play for the national title. You're a top-notch player. And so until we can be in that 5 to 8 teams that are in the hunt year in and year out, that's where the kids want to go, all the so-called top players in America. So I don't know what the answer is, but I think we need better players? Yeah, I do.
And I will tell you, Shane, I thought before LSU and the fog rolled in last year, Florida was right there. Florida was right there. They weren't in that top five of Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, Georgia, Oklahoma, but they were next. They were right there at 6, 7, or 8, somewhere in there with Oregon and Penn State and whoever. And then something changed when the LSU game then played well but lost to Alabama. Nobody cared about the Cotton Bowl. Then doesn't it feel like they were right there, man? They were right on the cusp of just outside that five, and then the bottom kind of fell out.
They were. And, you know, we had a bunch of NFL players that were helping us get to that point.
Yeah.
And now I talked to an NFL guy the other day, and he said, you know, for the draft eligible guys, maybe one guy, Kyer Elam.
Wow.
I mean, that, you know, now it's maybe some in the sixth, seventh round, but
I get it.
But you know, you lost Pitts, you lost Tony, you lost Trask, and those were all McElwain guys. So I think time will tell of what kind of players Coach Mullen's bringing in. But yeah, we have to recruit better. I think the facility will definitely help, but we got to get to into that point now where we're one of the top eight teams competing. And I agree with you. We were right there last year and then kind of fell apart.
Final thing, Shane Matthews with us. How does the game play out? I've got it about 38-21, 38-24, Georgia. I think Florida will play hard in this game. I think they've got a chip on their shoulder. I think they're ticked off. I think we saw that against Alabama. People gave them no chance, and they played awfully hard in that game. If they hadn't have gotten lost the first round or so of the fight, it would have been a pretty good fight. They made it a good fight at the end. But I don't see that. I think it's going to be hard this game. I got it 38-21, give or take. How do you see the game?
Yeah, I got like 38-17, 38-14, something like that. I just if we cannot turn the football over. If we turn the football over, it's going to be a bloodbath. So we need to make some big plays in the passing game. I don't think we're going to be able to run it on them, but we can't give them a short field, and you can't drive 70, 80 yards on their defense. So we need a short field to score, and we got to score touchdowns when we have the opportunity. But the biggest thing is we cannot turn it over. We have to win the turnover battle to have a chance.
Shane Matthews, in my mind, as I said earlier, along with Herschel Walker, the two best players who ever played in this series, 11 touchdowns, no picks, beat Georgia three times in a row, a two-time SEC Player of the Year. Shane, thanks for joining us, brother. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Frank. Take care, buddy.
All right. Shane Matthews checking in, and a good buddy of mine, and he's right. He's like everybody else, respectfully concerned about where the program is now. We'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little golf. There's an awfully cool women's match play happening on the First Coast. Professional women's golf. I want you to learn a little bit about that. That's next. Stay with us. I'm glad you're with us. Busy week. FSU, Clemson, Florida, Georgia. Jags on the road to play Seattle. We'll be on the road on Friday. I will not be here, but Lauren and Hayes will have it for you. But a cool event on the First Coast, celebrating, not to celebrating women's golf, but a display of terrific women's golf. It's the PXG Women's Match Play Championship. It's sort of a two-weekend event, two events, really. My buddy Mark Berman is kind of the czar of this thing, joins us now on the program. Mark, thanks for joining us. How are you, man?
I am so good, my friend. How are you?
We are doing great. This is a cool event, but it's unusual. There's a stroke play element that's at the King and the Bear that evolves into a match play element that is at Slammer and the Squire for professional women's golfers. Tell us about how this whole thing, I know how paramount this was, you were in this thing, Mark. Tell us about why the format and how it came about. This is a cool deal.
Yeah. Thank you, man. I appreciate it. I do. I'm hyped up a little bit. Just rolling off the golf course now. Today was spectacular. The weather was absolutely a Chamber of Commerce day. Golf course is in ridiculous condition. Our leaders are, I think, one's at 8 under, one's at 9 under. So there's spectacular golf going on out here. The tournament, like you said, it's the format's unique. Everything about this thing is unique, right? It's really a celebration of women's initiatives on and off the course. But, you know, this week is 54 holes of stroke play. We're going into final round action tomorrow. We got six players under par, four within a couple strokes of the leaders who are obviously lighting it up. And those two are just on their way back from second stage of Q school. Jessica Porvaznik, who's a three-time All-American at Ohio State, is pretty much going to battle with Sophia Garcia, who went to Texas Tech. Sophia was a top five player last week in stage two at Q school. Jess missed advancing by one shot, shooting a 75, unfortunately, in the final round. So the talent is ridiculous. And honestly, what we're doing and what this all is all about is to really shine a light on women's professional golf in general, because I don't have to tell you that it's obviously not as popular. It doesn't get the attention that men's professional golf gets, but specifically shining a light on, I think, as a ball player or a baseball guy, what you'll appreciate is kind of this triple A level, right, professional women's golf, who are a stroke away from being on the big tour. And, you know, these aren't, I've kind of grown fond of saying, these are girls you haven't heard of yet. And this is going to be the chance. I remember sitting in the Suns ballpark a bunch of years ago watching like Andre Dawson, right, and Mike Stanton and these guys, and now they're all stars, right? So here's the chance to see these young women who are every bit as good, every bit as talented. We've got five players who've been in the U.S. Open We got seven players who've been in the U.S. Women's Amateur and the British Open. We've got three young women who played on the University of Washington National Championship team 2 years ago. We got a girl from the University of Florida. We got local players, Catherine O'Donnell, who played at UNC, went to Nice. So there's talent out here that people just don't know exists, and our job is really shining a light on them. So that's my pitch.
Love it. I love the pitch.
Mark, I know all about it. We got to broadcast live from Maserati that one day. For people who don't know, tickets are free. Tell them where to go.
Yeah, tickets are free. Tickets are free. So you can go to the website to get tickets. We're asking people to register, but if you show up, we're certainly not going to turn you away. PXGWPC.com is the free ticket website. Register. We'll get you print your ticket. You come out. You watch the show for free. We've got concessions on the golf course. I mean, honestly, it's phenomenal. And then next week starts the match play. So I kind of missed that part. So match play is these young women, like, women's golf doesn't really play a lot of match play, right?
Right.
Men's golf has match play. They've got Stableford. They've got a little variety of theme. Women's golf doesn't have that. So we're providing, I mean, these girls are so fired up to play match play, right? It's like they're in the stroke play that we're running this week seeds next week's match play. So, you know, one of these girls will be number, and they all advance. There's no cut. Everybody moves through because we wanted that to be the format where everybody gets a chance to play match play. And the other reason we're doing 2 weeks back to back is it's expensive to be, I mean, it's not even expensive. Like, these are like the only professional athletes that actually pay to go to work, right?
Sure.
Our number one money winner on this tour, the WAPT, Jessica Porvaznik, right? 6 year pro. Last year, she made $23,000. She was the money winner. All right. It costs $60,000 to mount a professional campaign, right? So she had a good year by not losing more than $40,000.
Yeah.
Right. So we're trying to provide playing opportunities for these women. We're trying to provide a spotlight so more people know about them, trying to provide the spotlight so sponsors can understand that we need to grow this part of the game and get some eyes on it. So it's a big mission, and we're stoked. And honestly, just come out and watch, and you'll see for yourself, and you'll never forget the appreciation. And do I have time for like a real quick story?
Yes, you do. Go ahead. You got time.
Okay. I'm going to give you like a teaser of what we're doing tomorrow.
Okay.
So Pro-Am, we had the Pro-Am on Monday. We raised $50,000, by the way, for investing in kids, which raises money for underserved public schools.
Right.
$50,000 in a women's Pro-Am. It was unbelievable. One of the guys played in the Pro-Am, had no, you know, didn't know anything about women's golf, never played with a professional women's golfer, big golf guy, plays in Pro-Ams all over the planet. And he came to watch the tournament today. He said, "Mark, how can I get involved in this tournament?" And I said, "What do you want to do?" And he said, "I want to put some money into the purse." So tomorrow we're going to make an announcement about this company who basically, or this guy who just rolled in and said, "Here, I'm going to put, I'm going to add a lot of money to this purse for these young women."
That's
awesome.
That's a great story. And
it's unbelievable.
And again, it's phenomenal golf. It's at two phenomenal tracks, the King and the Bear and the Slammer and Squire, both World Golf Village tracks. You know, if you're listening to me right now, you've probably played them both. You'll love it. If you get a chance, it doesn't cost anything to watch and support. And we'll learn more about Mark's initiative and the initiative of many others to grow women's golf. Mark, thank you for spending some time. It's the PXG Women's Match Play Championship. Go to pxgwpc.com, register for your free tickets, and go watch these ladies play. They are terrific. Mark, good luck with it, man. We appreciate you joining us.
You guys are awesome. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care. Mark Berman, who's worked really, really hard to build this thing. Lauren, we've had enough lunches and talks, and Mark's a friend of ours. You can see the passion he had. And that's what I want people to understand. Women's golf doesn't get the attention men's golf does, but it should get more attention. It should. It's real. It's a very real thing. The players are fantastic. I hope you get a chance. It's a tough time of year. Everyone knows Florida Georgia's here, and the Jaguars are playing, and the Noles are starting to play better, and it's a football time. And Mark knows that, and they know that. But he told you the numbers. You have to pay just to pursue this dream, and hopefully that'll become a better world for some of these ladies. So hope you get out there and watch it. And congrats to Mark and all the folks that are making that.
Yeah, Mark's daughter Hannah played at JU.
Very good player.
Yep, really good golfer at JU. And certainly we're going to be talking a lot more about a local female golfer who I think is going to play college golf in the near future when Caitlin Schroeder.
Yeah.
I mean, I know she'll play college golf. We just don't know where she will play college golf. And so, certainly it'll be fun to follow her. And then eventually she'll make her way into this professional world. And they have a free junior clinic on Sunday as well. So lots of fun events. You can also go to womensmatchplaychampionship.com to learn more as well.
Yeah. So hopefully, well, Mark, thanks for joining us. Let's get it back to other sports we've talked about, including a little bit of hardball. Game two is tonight in Houston. We'll talk about that and more when we continue. Frank Frangie, Hayes Carline, Lauren Brooks with you.
Valdez just trying to fight to stay in the game. This one is a rocket into left and gone. 5-0 Atlanta here in the third inning as Duvall goes deep. What a start to game one for the Braves.
It's a Kitchen and Flooring Design Center Wednesday on The Frangie Show. Make your home dreams come true with the Kitchen and Flooring Design Center.
Frank Frangie, Hayes Carline, Lauren Brooks, Andrew Gibson with you. Game two is tonight of the World Series. Hayes, would you like, should I just go ahead and put my food order in and the three of you guys divvy it up? Is that the best way we should do this? What's your feelings on matters like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, by all means, go ahead and do that if you'd like, and we'll keep it in our pocket, and we'll see if we need that information or not. I will be surprised if we don't see a little bit more action last night after only one dinger among the players that we drafted. So I think business picks up tonight, and hopefully in a good way for me.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, a serious question.
You're up 1-0 in your
I know,
already drawing.
I know. Hey, I've always said talk trash when you can. Okay, smack when you can. Hey, when you grew up, when you and your buddies and your dad were all Braves fans, mid-80s, right? Right.
Yeah, my dad wasn't a Braves fan. Oh, that was something I kind of discovered on my own.
Okay. So you're a Braves fan in the mid-80s. Was your favorite Braves team, and Gibby, I want to ask you about the history of it, but obviously Gibby was born in 1990, so it's a little different. But was your favorite Braves team the Horner, Murphy, Claudel, Washington team? Was it more the Gant, Justice, Pendleton team, which was a better team, obviously? I mean, Hayes, where did the Braves, kind of the different Braves rank for guys like you that were a Braves fan as best as you could be back then?
Yeah, my favorite teams were the teams that didn't win, but I was young, so I didn't care. I loved Dale Murphy, so I'd be locked in. And they weren't like, I mean, in 1984 was probably the first year that I started watching them. They were, you know, like 80 and 82. Then they were terrible. But yeah, I mean, I loved them. I watched all the time. I watched when they were 54 and 106 and 88. And then, you know, finally they started to get good. I just never... Like the fact that they weren't good for whatever reason as a kid, that just didn't bother me. They were on and I liked them. And so I never got devastated when they lost, but I never dreamed they'd be good. So when they finally got good in 91, it was amazing to watch.
Gibby, when you look back at old Braves, I mean, look, I was born in 58, so I have no remembrance of the 60 World Series team. But I've read a lot about it because it was a storybook team, and Maz hit the home run. Gibby, your dad, other people you know that were Braves fans, is there a charm to the Horner Murphy teams, the Brett Butler, Glenn Hubbard, Rafael Ramirez teams to you? To even though you weren't alive for them, your family, does that group resonate with you at all?
Yeah, for sure. I think Dale Murphy definitely does. So my grandpa, my dad's dad, is an absolute, I mean, huge, huge Braves fan. He's almost 90 still, and I hope the Braves win the World Series this year, in part because I want to see my grandpa see the Braves win the World Series. He's 90 years old, and he appreciates all the past history of the Braves and the teams that have come and gone. But I think that era that you're talking about, for sure, you know, for me, I remember when I was born, like you said, 90, the Braves weren't very good, and then Chipper Jones got there, and they started to build pieces around him, the pitching staff, with Maddox, Glavine, and Smoltz, and they won 90 or more games pretty much my entire life. There were a few exceptions, but they were incredible in the 90s and in the 2000s, of course. But I go back to the 2002, 2003 teams that won 100-plus games. That was Chipper's prime of his career, pretty much. He was getting into his 30s, but he was still a very good player. But, yeah, those teams certainly resonate.
See, you talk about 90. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I want to say in 90, they won like 60-some-odd games.
65.
And then by 91, they were in the 90s. right?
Yeah, so it went 90, they won 65, 91, they won 94.
Yeah, so they went from 65. Think about that. Think about that stat. From 65 wins to 94 wins, and that was Terry Pendleton won the MVP, and Gant and Pendleton and Justice and Jeff Blauser and Lemke and all those guys, which we all remember that team. But I'll tell you, Hayes, back to the team you were talking about. I can tell you, I was a Pirates fan forever, right? But when the Superstation came along, we had just gotten out of college in 1980, and, yeah, a single guy, had no money, sports writers trying to get by, right? I worked at a bank full-time at that time, and sports writer, and the Superstation came along, and both the Cubs, and Hayes, you probably watched the Cubs a bunch too then, right? Because we all did, late mid-80s. But the Cubs and the Braves were the two teams you knew. I could tell you right now, that Braves team, the Braves, by the way, won their first 13 games in 82. They started 13-0. It was like one of the first really good teams they'd ever had, and they won the division. They won, I think it was still the West Division then, and the Cardinals won the East, and I think that's what it was. But they won the division in 82. Here's how locked in we were to that. Of course, I'm kind of sick this way. Here's your lineup, Hayes, for the 82 Braves. Brett Butler leading off. Glenn Hubbard batted second. Claudio Washington hit third. Murphy hit fourth. Bob Horner hit fifth. Chris Chambliss hit sixth. Bruce Benedict, the catcher, hit seventh. Rafael Ramirez hit eighth. That's off the top of my head. Lauren, I'm not looking at anything, but that's how locked in we were to that team. And we loved that team. They weren't my favorite team. I can even tell you, in 83, I went out to cover the Florida USC football game in Los Angeles. And we went to three Braves-Dodgers games. Me and a buddy of mine went to three Braves-Dodgers games when the Braves were still in the hunt. And then the Braves got beaten, and then they started, and then they got to being bad again. So I think there's charm to the Braves, no matter how old you are. I guess Hayes is my point here. If you're your age, the charm is the Dale Murphy, Bob Horner Braves. If you're Gibby's age, the charm is the Chipper Braves. If there's somewhere in between y'all's two ages, it's the Gant, Pendleton, Dave Justice Braves. But I think there's charm to all those old Braves. So even though I'm not a Braves fan, Hayes, I'll bet you know tons of people that you grew up with that are the same way you are.
We're just a charming franchise.
Yes.
But I think that's true. I really believe that.
No, I agree. I think they've always been, I think, it's easy for me to say it, but I think they've always been likable. It's not like they went out and paid Maddox, Glavine, and Smoltz a ton of cash. They made a savvy trade to acquire Smoltz. They did acquire Maddox in free agency, and they developed Glavine. So, they drafted Chipper. So it was a organization that made a lot of great moves. And so I think that even when they were winning, again, you wish that they would have won more than the one World Series. But the consistency was incredible. And yeah, I think they've always, whatever era you're talking about,
right,
I think they had a certain charm. And because they were always on, I mean, I'd watch the Cubs during the day and I'd watch the Braves at night.
Hey, Gibby, who was in the John Smoltz trade? Who they give up?
It's funny you mention that. I can't remember the name, but somebody tweeted
veteran,
me.
Cagey veteran.
Hayes, who'd they give up?
I forgot.
Doyle Alexander.
Yes, that's who it was.
They gave up Doyle Alexander.
A forgettable name.
For John Smoltz. Let me tell you how bad that trade was for the Tigers. You want me to tell you how bad it was? The Tigers had to throw in another player to get the Braves to just take John Smoltz for Doyle Alexander. A left-handed pitcher named Chuck Carey. How about that? That one's free of charge, Hayes. The Tigers wanted Doyle Alexander so badly, they gave up John Smoltz, a young guy, and had to throw in another player to get him. So, but those were great years. Those are great times in Braves history. Gibby, if this Braves team wins it, will it be the greatest Braves team in Atlanta history? I mean, the other one, they won in 95.
Right.
And I can't imagine that anybody could compare any team to a team that had Glavine, Maddox, Smoltz, and Chipper, yet this team would, again, there's only been two, they went to Atlanta in 66. There's only been one title since they got to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1995. This would be the second one. Where will this team rank, Gibby?
It'll be right there in the conversation as the best ever because, and think about this too, this has got to be the best Braves offense of all time. The entire infield nearly hit all 30 home runs. That's never happened before. I don't think in baseball history that they didn't all get there. They almost did. But Dansby Swanson, I think, hit 27. Ozzie hit 30. Right. I mean, the whole infield nearly hit 30 home runs. They don't certainly have the pitching that the Maddox, Glavine, Smoltz teams did, but the offense has a chance to be perhaps the best ever, and they could go win it all. Do you realize that? So last night the Braves win. It was their first World Series win since 96 because they got swept by the Yankees in 99. So last night was the first time since 96 they had won a World Series game.
Wow, I knew it was the first time they'd been since 99. Didn't realize that. Now, Brian grew up a Braves fan, right?
He did.
Is he back in or is he doesn't care?
No, he's watching, he's hoping the Braves win.
When did he quit being a Braves fan?
It's a good question. I don't know. Probably around college, I would say.
So
he wasn't a baseball fan for a long time, and then we became Rays fans together.
Okay, so he was a Braves fan, and then he just quit following him. He wasn't a diehard.
I don't know when that ended. I mean, I know as a kid he was, card collecting.
Yeah,
Braves fan.
I just know in this area. As I was growing up, and then even and in my 20s and 30s, there were Braves fans that if you were a college football, you could root for the Gators or the Noles,
right,
or Alabama Georgia, whoever. But you were a Braves baseball fan. Now, again, if your family's from Pittsburgh and your family coached in the organization, you're different. If you're Rick Ballew and you moved down here from Boston, but if you were from around here, if you were a Southern guy around here. You rooted for those Braves, and I wonder how much of that is rekindled. I wonder how much of that's there. So
I remember when the Braves came here and played at the where the Suns played,
yep.
And it was a huge deal. Me and my friends were thrilled that we could go. I got Albert Hall's autograph,
okay.
If you remember him.
I do,
and Bruce Benedict's, and was thrilled. Those were the two guys that we were able to get close enough to get autographs. But, yeah, when the Braves came to Jacksonville, it was unbelievable.
I saw Hank Aaron play here. The Braves came here in 74, I think. Ralph Garr, Rico Carty, Hank Aaron, they were all on that team. And they came here to play at Wolfson Stadium. So it was a big deal. So we'll see what happens.
I will say on social media, like, for instance, Instagram, people that I did not know were Braves fans are posting things about the Braves playing. So I think even, yes, like you said, people who are not necessarily diehard fans, they are absolutely sucked into this.
Yeah, I did when the Sid Bream thing happened, and I was just starting in radio, I did a I Hate the Braves shtick. I didn't really hate them. It was just kind of fun radio shtick. But even then, it felt like it was fading just a little bit. But it'll be interesting to see. Gibby going to win tonight or no?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, look, it's a game where the Braves, last night they jumped out early. Tonight somebody else is hitting a home run. Maybe one of our guys will hit a home run tonight besides Adam Duvall.
By the way.
Let's go Altuve.
Braves win tonight, it's over. Agreed?
I agree, yes. And look, they have Max Fried on the mound. So, Jose Urquiz, a pretty solid pitcher, but I think Max Fried, he's got to go 6 or 7 tonight because the bullpen was pitching into the third inning last night. So, yeah, I think we get it done.
Braves win tonight. I think it's over. I really believe that. So we'll see what happens. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get it back to a little bit of football. Don't forget the State Farm College Football Report is at 5:15. We'll talk a little more Jaguars football after this. Stay with us.
Is Bobby Cox still the manager? And Fred McGriff, my old teammate, Fred McGriff, is he still playing?
No. You talk about your baseball days very much?
Ronnie Gant, is he still playing shortstop?
No.
So I must have missed something in the last 20 years.
So you don't even follow the Braves?
Dale Murphy and Bob Horner still.
All retired.
I'm still a fan, I guess. But Chipper?
More college football talk coming up just around the corner, but let's get into a little bit of pro football. Jags in Seattle. Hey, Hayes, how much longer for Pete Carroll? Does he rebuild again, or does he get out of this? What do you think?
I think he gets out because I think Russell Wilson is probably on his way out. And I think as soon as Russell Wilson is on his way out, it just wouldn't make sense for Pete Carroll to stick around. So I do wonder if this is the beginning of the end for what's been a brilliant legacy for Pete Carroll in Seattle. When he left, there was a lot of sentiment of it's not going to work. He's only doing this to escape USC because sanctions are coming. And it wasn't viewed as being a guaranteed success, but obviously they did a great job drafting. And I think they've had a great run. But the second they trade Russell Wilson, which I think is happening this offseason, I think at that point, Pete Carroll is going to be out the door. But he'll probably be out the door first. But I think as soon as he knows that Russell Wilson is on the market, he will go ahead and retire.
I mean, I will say, as far as 70-year-olds go, he's a young 70. So if he wants to continue coaching, if he wants to take another job, it wouldn't surprise me if he left Seattle and took another NFL job.
Yeah. We'll see. He is a young 70. Now, he is a really young 70. How many guys, by the way, I'm sure this number's out there, but how many guys have college national championships and Super Bowls? Jimmy Johnson, Carroll, is there anybody else? Hayes, am I missing somebody?
Barry Switzer.
He does, doesn't he? Barry Switzer's got both. Amazingly, by the way, but he does. But Switzer's got both. Jimmy's got both.
And Urban Meyer will in about 2 years.
There you go. And then Urban will have both. But that's it, right? There's nobody else. I'm not missing anybody, am
yeah,
I?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Is that it? They're the only ones. Is he the most successful both? I guess Jimmy. But, I mean, is Jimmy, if you look at the years, is Jimmy regarded as the most successful combo ever, would you say?
I would say Jimmy is. But Pete, I think, gives, you know, it's interesting. I don't have their records in front of me. And obviously Jimmy Johnson with the Dolphins was mediocre. Yeah. Pete Carroll's done it longer. But Jimmy Johnson, because of all the Super Bowl success, I think I'd have to put him one and Pete Carroll two. And then Barry Switzer, a distant third.
Yeah, they won the AP title in 2003-04, the BCS title in 2005, and barely lost that 2006 game to Texas. That was a dynasty now. I mean, that was seven consecutive, when he was at USC, seven consecutive top four finishes. Now, I know FSU had the 14, and nobody, but he had seven consecutive. Think about this. He had, you ready for this, Hayes? 33 consecutive weeks is the AP number one team. Think about, digest that for a second. 33 weeks in a row?
Yeah, it's incredible. And Pete Carroll had the famous comment that is still sometimes echoed even today, but it was the, why would I go to the NFL in every recruiting class I can bring in 5 to 6 first rounders? In the NFL, I'm only going to get one first rounder every year. And, you know, that was the most concise way I think anybody's ever put it in terms of why coaching at the two different levels is so different if you're coaching in an elite powerhouse and you're an elite recruiter, because you really are bringing in several first round picks every single year. You're not having to only have one pick out of the first 32.
In college, Pete Carroll was 97-19. In college, Jimmy Johnson was 52-9.
Okay, so he did it longer. Both had great records.
Yeah.
Pete Carroll had 3 Heisman Trophy winners in a four-year stretch.
And one of those is stripped, right?
Yeah, Reggie Bush, but he did have them. And he did. But 3 in a four-year stretch, Carson Palmer, Matt Leinart, and Reggie Bush. It's pretty amazing. And then, realistically, should have 2 Super Bowls. He should have the second Super Bowl. He doesn't. I mean, there's a lot of guys that should have something that they don't have. I get it. But a pretty amazing coach. I'm with you, Hayes. I don't sense that Pete Carroll does this for the long haul. I don't sense that. I mean, he's already done it for the long haul. I don't. Now, to your point, Lauren, he's a young 70, and some guys just want to keep on coaching. Now, coaching football, particularly college football, he's a pro coach. Coaching football is the one job that nobody ever wants to retire from. You ever notice that? They never want to stop. Or coaching anything.
Sure, but I mean, it's hard to walk away. If, let's say, all right, Matt Nagy, everyone thinks might be fired in Chicago. He's going to inherit Justin Fields, who's a lot like Russell Wilson.
Whoever gets that job.
Right, but I'm just saying, if Pete Carroll, let's say, parts ways with Seattle, why would he not go to Chicago, take over that job, and make $8 million
a year?
Question.
Hey, yeah, if he leaves Seattle, is he a guy, in this age where all the NFL seems to do, David Culley's an exception, but is hire the young...
David Meyer's an exception.
Yeah, right. Well, good point. But so often they hire these young offensive-minded guys. Do you hire Pete Carroll if you're Team X in the NFL?
I think absolutely. I think he'd be basically the version of Andy Reid, where Philadelphia fired him. A lot of people were stunned. Kansas City says, okay, we'll hire Andy Reid.
You're probably right.
I think it would be similar to that. If Pete Carroll wanted to continue to do it, I don't think the age would work against him. Again, this is a league where, you know, it's a 3 to 4 year deal anyway, usually at best. So, but I do think that's where it's headed. Cause I mean, you look at what Seattle still has in front of it. I mean, they'll probably get Russell back, but you're 2-5. I think they have a tough game Sunday against the Jaguars. If Russell was playing, I think the Seahawks would win easily, but he's not. It's Trevor Lawrence versus Geno Smith, and I think the Jaguars have a good chance to win that game. But even beyond that, Seattle will have its bye. You still play Green Bay, Arizona, San Francisco, the Rams, the Cardinals again. You know, so when you've already lost five, it's going to be hard for them to dig out of it. And it just feels like their roster is sort of teetering a little bit. I think they'll always be competitive with Russell Wilson. And if Russell Wilson ends up staying in Seattle, then I think Pete Carroll will stay. But yes, if Russell Wilson and the Seahawks divorce, I think Pete Carroll calls it. And yeah, I could see it being, they'd have to let him out of his contract. I'm assuming he's not in his last year. I don't think they'd fire Pete Carroll, but if Pete was ready to move on and Seattle was ready to move on, then I don't think they'd have any issue. I don't think they'd seek draft compensation for another team to hire him.
He's thought to be paid about $11 million a year, so $8 million would be a pay decrease.
This is his, 11th year now in Seattle? This is his 11th year in Seattle, right? Okay. Let me make sure I got this right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. This is his 12th year. This is his 12th year in Seattle. In 11 previous years, he's missed the playoffs twice. Do you realize that?
In 11
previous years, he's missed the playoffs twice. Hayes, and once it was with a 9-7 record, by the way. Okay, he's missed the playoffs twice in his 11 years. Once was with a 9-7 record. Since going 7-9 his first 2 years, including one that got him in the playoff, he has had that 9-7 record that he missed the playoffs in 17. Is the only time in the last 9 seasons they haven't had double-digit victories. Digest that for a second.
It's been remarkable. And, you know, obviously Russell Wilson is the biggest reason why, but Pete Carroll also built the Legion of Boom, which was unbelievable defense. It was something that at the time, you know, back in, you know, 2011, it wasn't something that you were seeing a lot in the NFL. And it's not overly sophisticated, but when you've got unbelievable athletes, if you know what you want and you're able to go acquire those players. Again, they drafted brilliantly. It's not like they built that with a bunch of first round picks. Richard Sherman was a late round pick. Brandon Browner was a late round, you know, was not a premium selection. So when you look at what they were able to do to build that unbelievable secondary and then the defense up, it really was brilliant front office by John Schneider and Pete Carroll in building it. And it's a chapter of the league that will always be noted throughout, because that defense, you're not going to see too many defenses now in the NFL have their own name, because we're just not seeing good defense being played collectively, let alone great defense. And the Legion of Boom might be one of the last truly great defenses that we see in this league.
There was a time a few years ago, Hayes, that the Titans secondary liked to call itself "My Man Catches No Balls."
Right.
Shocking that did not take off. Before the season, we thought the NFC West was the best division in all of the NFL. What do you think is now?
Well, for me, I have to think through them. But the NFC West is still very good. It's just Seattle fell apart. Right?
Well, and the 49ers are also 2-4.
Yeah, I guess you're right. So, well, let's go through them. Not them. Maybe the AFC Central, or the AFC North, rather.
Yeah, the AFC North, I would think.
Because the Steelers have they're in fourth place, and they're at 500, so everybody's 500 or better. And maybe them. One more Pete Carroll stat. How about this one, Hayes? 20 years between USC and the Seahawks, 20 years. 20, okay? 3 times they won fewer than 9 games. 3!
Yeah.
In 20 years of those two places.
You'd be a fool not to hire him if you're an NFL
team. Think about that.
And he did it a very new school way. I mean, you know, it wasn't as in vogue 10, 12 years ago to be more, you know, player friendly, not being the disciplinarian guy, letting players be who they are. You know, that was something that Pete Carroll really introduced to the NFL, and it had unbelievable success. His tree, the branches, you know, weren't able to recapture it. We saw that here in Jacksonville with Gus Bradley, who basically took a carbon copy of Pete Carroll's program and applied it here. And obviously it didn't work out. But there's no doubt the impact Pete Carroll has had on the NFL. I mean, I'll be curious to see what kind of traction he gets for Canton, because he does only have the one, and normally as a coach, you got to get multiple to get into that conversation. But he's been so consistent, and the fact that he not only developed a first ballot Hall of Fame quarterback, which I believe Russell Wilson will be, but also building that defense, he really does have a strong legacy, and did it in a place where they really hadn't had a lot of success in Seattle traditionally. So it will be interesting to see when Pete Carroll is done and the 5 years are up and he's able to be talked about for it, what kind of traction he gets as a Hall of Fame coach.
We'll take a break. When we come back, Lauren and I will be joined by the State Farm College Football Report guys, Pat Dooley, Tom Block, and Joe Zagacki. So stay with us.
It's the State Farm College Football Report with Pat Dooley on the Gators, Tom Block on the Noles, and Joe Zagacki on the Canes. Brought to you by your area State Farm agent.
Here we go. Let's start with Gator Talk. Pat Dooley checks in. His report brought to you by State Farm agents Ron McCann, Mike Tozzle, Kathy Scott, and Jim Register. Pat, the last time I was this convinced Florida would not win was 1989. That's the last time. Now, I know the last McElwain game, everything was going on. We all knew that. So I guess you could call that. That was a weird one. But I think it's going to be real tough for the Gators this week. Am I missing some stuff that could happen? What do you think?
Well, two things. One, I want to, first of all, say happy birthday to my brother, James. Probably listening up there in Jacksonville. And I know he listens to the show all the time.
Yeah, we just saw him. We saw him at lunch about a week or two ago.
Yeah, I think he's 39. pretty amazing that my parents would have kids that far apart. But anyway, look. You can't erase that McElwain last game out of your you knew what was going to happen in that game. That game was over before they even got on a bus because of what was going on. So you knew that how that game was going to end. You only knew just pencil in the score. The 88 game. The other one would have been the last Ron Zook game because he had gotten fired that week.
Good point.
But the truth is, If they had played as hard, the whole game as they did late in the game, they almost came back and won the game.
Lost by seven. Yep.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, it does feel like just get it over with, give us the final score, and let's move on to the Anthony Richardson era.
And to that end, great segue. Does that start this week or no? How is that going to play out?
I don't know that it starts this week. I think it'll be very similar to what you might have seen in LSU, or it may not be. It could be more about what they've seen, during the season with Emory Jones getting a bulk of the carries, a bulk of the plays, and Anthony Richardson coming in and spelling him. But again, we don't know what their plan is, but I think their plan is to play both guys and see who's hot and go with the hot hand. But I would think, and I've told you this before, the rest of their schedule is really soft. I mean, go ahead and let him get his confidence up playing in those games because he's clearly the better quarterback.
Pat, it seems crazy to me that the last time Georgia was a bigger favorite than Florida, or than the 14-point spread that they are against Florida, was 1971. So that being said, do you think we'll see something like we saw in 2014 with Michael McNeely's fake field goal? Do you think we see some antics like that?
Well, that definitely could be a factor. That 1971 team was bad, man. They were bad. Right. That was the year that Doug Dickey ran the option with John Reeves.
Remember?
That did not go well. No. Carlos Alvarez was walking around with one leg. It was not good. Florida's been a bigger favorite back in 2009. They were 16.5, I think. So, but that's just the way it kind of goes. I would think that. Look, we have seen the least special teams I think I've ever seen in Florida. When they blocked the punt last week, I was like blown away. I couldn't believe it. And then when I watched the play again, I realized it was just because nobody blocked the guy. That was a terrible play by LSU. And you would have thought maybe that was kind of the beginning of what they were going to be like. But, of course, it didn't work out that way. But special teams haven't done much. All they've had done is miss an extra point that cost them a game, get a field goal block that cost them a game. You know, it's not been a good look. So maybe they will try to ignite it. You know, that's what his mentor, Dan Mullen's mentor, Urban Meyer, was notorious for. Taking a risk and running a fake punt from your own 20-yard line against Arkansas in the SEC championship game, stuff like that. And Dan had a little bit of that early, but he kind of gotten away from that. He just wants the ball.
Yeah, I will say this. We saw it in a Kentucky game. He did not go for some fourth downs that he normally would have. And I think that's lack of confidence in his offense. I really do.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, in your mind, you still think they're splitting this quarterback play 50-50. That boggles my mind that they might do that, given what we saw against LSU and given the fact that that has resulted in a 4-3 team. You still think so, huh?
I think they go into this game with a plan for the two quarterbacks to play in the first three series. And then they see what happens, and they go from that point. I don't think it's so much we're going to play both these guys half and half because they're not that different skill sets. You know, they're really pretty. I mean, one's bigger, one's stronger, one's faster, one's got a bigger, better grip on the offense. But so they're not really that different, though. So I would think that they will go out there. Maybe Emory starts. Maybe he plays the second series. Then it's Emory, like we've seen, and we'll see what happens then. And then they decide what they're going to do from that point on. They may really literally make an in-game decision on who the quarterback's going to be. But again, we're not getting a lot of info out of that camp over there. I call it Camp Scooter now because all the players are taking scooters back to their locker room. So.
Pat, final thing here. There's some doubt in the fan base now, whether it's recruiting, Todd Grantham, which quarterback they've picked. There's some doubt in the fan base. If they get rolled in this game, can that doubt turn into a hot seat? Is it too early for that for Dan Mullen?
Yeah, I don't see it being a hot seat. You know, I talk a lot about real hot seats and perceived hot seats, and I think the real hot seats are the perceived hot seats are the ones like people had on Mike White last year. Yeah. There was not a real hot seat.
Right.
And I don't think there's a real hot seat on Dan Mullen. However, I will say this. I think Gator fans are now, even the ones that are on his side and believe that the coach should be able to decide who the quarterback, the sane ones that I'm talking about, they're all kind of wondering if this is the right guy too. So when that starts to happen and you get people that are sane and people that are big boosters who don't know for sure if this is the right guy, that creeps into the AD and the president. And so we'll see where that goes. I don't think he has any chance on being a hot seat this year, but he has a chance on being on a hot seat next year, depending on how this season finishes out.
Yeah, fair point. Pat Dooley checking in, talking Florida, Georgia. Pat, thanks, buddy.
We'll see you guys.
All right, let's move down to, or over to Tallahassee. Our pal Tom Block checked in from the Seminole Radio Network. His report is brought to you by State Farm agents Margie Williams, Scott Hobson, Mike Nickus, Randy Taylor, and Craig Dewhurst. Tom, for the first time in a while, these last two or three weeks, there's some energy and momentum in that program. That's got to feel awfully good. I don't care who they beat last week. They've lost enough games. There's clear energy, I think, in the program. Do you sense that?
I do, and Frank, I'm just thinking about the last two questions you asked and how this season has turned around. We've gone from 0-4 to you just asked a hot seat question for Gainesville,
and now you're
pointing out momentum in Tallahassee.
Yeah, good
look,
point.
Does it mean they're going to win this weekend? No, but I think a couple things here. One, and this was true even when FSU was 0-4, the players are bought in and believers in Mike Norvell and the coaches, and I think that the most succinct way I could put it is that for the first time in a long time, and I mean maybe since 2013, FSU is finally better than the sum of its parts, which speaks to how bought – now they need to get better parts to compete at the stage that they want to, but for what they have right now, I think they're really playing at an optimal level, and so they're believing, and that's where you want to be when you go in as an underdog against a team that – Clemson has better players, Frank, but if Clemson is having some doubt because they haven't had a season like this in several years, who knows what transpires on Saturday.
Tom, I know he's not the starting quarterback, but I have loved the comments from McKenzie Milton as far as supporting the younger quarterbacks that are starting to get playing time ahead of him.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're in such a it's society today outside of sports too, but everything, we have to judge it immediately, and is it a boom or is it a bust? And there's some who want to call Mackenzie Milton to FSU a bust because he didn't wind up being the starting quarterback. I couldn't argue or be more disagreeable with that sentiment. I'm sorry that my phone's beeping in right now. Because when Mackenzie committed to FSU last year, it was a big deal. Nobody knew if he was going to be the same Mackenzie or not, but he could have gone anywhere, and he chose Florida State. And FSU got momentum on the recruiting trail, or at least in the transfer portal, at that time. Jermaine Johnson followed shortly after from Georgia, even if his rationale was different. I mean, he may not have come to FSU because of Milton, but it gave Florida State, it put him on the national radar, so to speak. And then he comes in, and we'll never know the answer to the question, how much harder did Jordan Travis work because he's competing with Milton? Nor will we really know the answer to the question, how much better is Jordan as a quarterback because of how helpful Milton is in the quarterback room? And so, and that's true for Chubba Purdy and Tate Rodemaker, too. So I can't say enough about it. I know it didn't translate on the field the way we all wanted the Disney ending, or at least it hasn't yet for Mackenzie. But I think it's been, to me, it's been a home run that they brought him in.
100% agree with you. I don't sense watching it from afar that he's failed. I sense that Jordan Travis has taken hold of the job, and that FSU football is in a better place than it's been in a while. I totally agree with what you said.
Go ahead.
These running backs are good. Corbin and Ward are good. I thought Corbin was pretty going into the season. I thought Corbin was pretty good. I knew nothing about Ward. These backs are pretty good, Tom. Did you know going in, or did you feel going in they'd both be good like this?
I thought they were good, but let's be candid about it. Corbin had a bad hamstring injury at Texas A&M.
Right.
And what I didn't know, and we started hearing about it in fall camp, 2 years removed from the injury, so I'm talking this year, we heard that he had the speed and the burst back. And, boy, when you see it on Saturdays, you realize that, I mean, he was good last year. He's really good this year. And then Trayshon Ward is a former walk-on. I think people know his story now, but somebody associated with the FSU defense told me that a year ago, Trayshon Ward was running scout team. And take this in context. Florida State's defense was not great last year, but he made the first-team defense look silly on a weekly or on a daily basis last year, to the point that the defense's coaches thought, you know what, this guy might be one of our better players, and we need to get him in the mix offensively. And that happened at the end of the year in the Duke game. He finally got a little run. And then this year, I'm not sure he's not better than Corbin now. And this is a former walk-on. He had smaller school offers. I think at one point he was maybe committed to Maryland or going to Maryland before they had their issues. But he's quite a find to be a walk-on and be as good as he is right now.
Tom, the FSU defense has improved drastically. What has been kind of the main reason for that?
Yeah, I would say that they're not playing as many guys, and specifically at the start of the year they had Jamie Robinson at the nickel, and they were running a bunch of guys through the safety position. Well, Kevin Knowles, who's a true freshman, has emerged and is better than Jamie was at the nickel spot, and it's allowed him to put Jamie at the safety position, and then pretty much they're playing the same five guys back there, the same two safeties, same two corners, and Kevin Knowles is a freshman. So it's cut down on the missed assignments. They're not the five most talented guys that people are putting out in their secondaries across the country, but they've been better and more consistent than what Florida State's trotted out there for a few years. So it's been good to see.
Tom, final thing. If they win, and they're a 10-point dog, but they're not a 28-point dog like they've been against Clemson the last few years. If they win this thing, that's the statement win for Mike Norvell, isn't it? Because they've gained some momentum. Then they've got back-to-back home games with ACC teams. That's the statement game if they win this game, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Now nationally, it will be presented as, boy, Clemson really has fallen off a cliff.
Right.
But following Florida State, let's be candid about FSU offensively. I love what Jordan Travis brings, but it's a one-dimensional offense. I mean, he is not a drop-back passer. So if you find a way to go into Clemson and end a 31-game winning streak for the home team, for as much as they struggle, they got a really good defense still. And if that happens, they've gone from 0-4 to 4-4 with a month of the season to play. It would definitely, without a doubt, it would be the biggest win of his brief Florida State career. But it would be a statement win.
Tom Block checking in from the Seminole Radio Network. Thank you, Tom.
You bet.
All right, let's head down to South Florida. Say hello to my pal Joe Zagacki, the play-by-play voice of the Canes. His report is brought to you by State Farm agent Joe McGee and Susan Helwig. Boy, Joe, if any team needed a win, boy, did Miami need that one on Saturday, didn't they?
Yeah, they sure did, Frank. Good win for the program. Good win for a lot of young players that are getting involved. Tyler Van Dyke looked really sharp again. And Miami has had an infusion of young players on their defense. They brought a lot of energy and passion. And so there's a big win for them against North Carolina State, a close win. They're right now playing in the house of close games, you know. Two narrow losses, and finally the scoreboard smiled on them last week.
Yeah, I got to tell you now, and not knowing the team very well, and it's hard to follow everybody's team, I thought Tyler Van Dyke would be the guy that had to play because Eric King was hurt. And I got to play somebody, might as well stick him in there. And then last week I got to watch. Like last week, Suzanne and I were in Savannah, and I had some time at night, so we just sat there and watched. Oh, boy, he's pretty good now. I mean, he's a big old guy to throw. I mean, the numbers are obviously, we know the numbers. He was 25 of 33 for 3.25 and 4 touchdowns. But forget the numbers. The eye test, I missed the boat on this, Joe. He's pretty good, this guy.
So far he has been. And, you know, he's from Glastonbury, Connecticut. Came to Miami as was the number two player in the state of Connecticut. And like I always say, you can find good players everywhere. Yeah. And was recruited by Dan Enos. And there are a lot of things that have been really good about him here in the last three games. Miami, with him at quarterback, they're averaging 33 points per game against the ACC. Forget about the Central Connecticut State game. The three games, Virginia, Carolina, NC State, 33 points per game. In the last 2 weeks, he has engineered 8 touchdown drives, 7 of them 75 yards or more. The other one was 65 yards. That's pretty good. That's pretty good execution. And he has thrown some exquisite touchdown passes. So he is the guy that will give them the chance on Saturday, because in order to beat Pittsburgh, you have to beat them with touchdowns through the air. And when you play Pittsburgh, it comes down to good passes equal touchdowns. Sounds easier than it is against them, but if he can land a few, you only need to land a few, you can win that game.
Yeah, certainly a tough game. Joe, allow me to be selfish here for a second. As a Jaguars fan, I'm always on the lookout for receivers. Charleston Rambo really impresses me. How is he going to be at the next level?
Yeah, I like Rambo a lot. I think he is really dedicated himself to becoming a quality player, an elite player. He's got really good speed, 4.4, 4.3 speed. I'm not sure what happened at Oklahoma. He had 76 career catches for Oklahoma, 43 in one season. But already at Miami, he has 44 catches for 549 yards, had a monster game against North Carolina State. He's been tough. He's been physical. He's been a good teammate. And he's a go-to player for Tyler Van Dyke. And I think every game out, he makes himself a little more money.
All right, final thing here, and you and I have had this talk. I don't, and just, again, from afar, I don't know that I sense that Manny Diaz is going to be the coach next year. I don't know. I'm just being honest with you. And I also know that the last four games are against teams that have had some struggles, even though, as we just talked to Tom, FSU surging a little bit here. But I think if he gets this win, because Pitt's pretty good, and they're at home, and the quarterback's really good, by the way, which I know you know. Kenny Pickett's a really good player. If he gets this one, I almost sense this is the one thing that could help Manny stem the tide a little bit, particularly if they got on a little bit of a run. Big game for him this week, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a gigantic game. They're all big for him. Every game
right.
becomes an indictment, you know, because he lost to Duke and FIU in year number one. That's really been, I think, the albatross that he's had to deal with, is people just go back to, they cannot fathom that Miami had a three-game losing streak that consisted of FIU, Duke, and Louisiana Tech. Yeah. So he's had to dig himself out of that trench since that time, and most people just look past last year, maybe because it was COVID or whatever. So this year got off to a very, very difficult start. You know, you can play that what-if game, Frank and Lauren. You missed a field goal, and you had a ball intercepted on the same play they scored a touchdown on last week to Rambo. And probably would have gone for a touchdown against Carolina for the game winner had it not been deflected. They are 3-4, they could easily be undefeated in conference play. They could easily be 3-0 in conference play. But if he beats Pittsburgh, you look at the rest of the schedule, Frank, and it's Florida State, Georgia Tech, Virginia Tech, and Duke.
Yep.
I don't think I missed anybody there.
Yeah, that's it.
You pretty much have to win those, right? Your rival is Florida State. And then, come on, would you go, if you're going to offer another coach a job, I'm just saying not now, but I think one of your pitches would be, if you went to ask somebody in the SEC, hey, you're interested in this job, would you rather play Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, or Georgia Tech, Virginia Tech, and Duke?
That's right. You're dead on, which is why if you get on a roll after you win this one, there may be hope yet. Joe Zagacki, the terrific play-by-play voice of the Miami Hurricanes. That game is at noon coming up on Saturday. Joe, thanks, buddy.
Okay, Frank Lauren, thank you.
All right, Joe Zagacki, checking in. He is the play-by-play voice of the Canes. That is the State Farm College Football Report. We'll bring back Hayes for one more segment after this, so stay with us. Almost out of time on a Florida-Georgia Wednesday. Lauren Brooks is here. Andrew Gibson is here. Hayes Carline is along. All right, now listen, Hayes. You've been on since the first quarterback draw in the FAU game. You've been on the Anthony Richardson train, right? Since day one.
Correct.
I have been patient guy. I have not jumped on the train. I have not been that guy. I've said Dan knows what he's doing. There may be things we're not seeing. We haven't had a big enough sample size. If we see Anthony Richardson play more, we may see some of the reasons why he's blah 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 blah. Well, now that I was kind of late to the party of this, I told Pat Dooley this, I can't fathom. No, I understand being coy with the media at this point. Why show your hand by now? But I can't fathom that he would alternate quarterbacks back and forth and play the guy with the hot hand like Pat thinks. Have I lost my mind? Not about what I want. Forget what I want, Hayes. Have I lost my mind to think that I can't believe that's how they would play this given the LSU game?
No, I think you're right. I think it's Anthony Richardson's game. I think Emory Jones will come in at times. I think it could be very similar to the plan last year where it was, Trask and Emory Jones, and Emory Jones would come in here and there. But I think it's Anthony Richardson's game. I think it has to be. I mean, if you're Dan Mullen, how can you look any Gators fan in the face if you play Emory Jones for half the snaps and lose this game? And expect them to have any confidence in what you're doing.
Well, not fans. What about your locker room?
Your administration. Anybody. Yeah. Anybody wearing that logo. And, so I agree. I just don't know how. Now, if he plays Emory Jones and Florida wins the game, as unlikely as that is, in my opinion,
right,
I'll be the first one to say, what, Dan Mullen, I tip my cap to you. You were dead on. But that's not going to happen. If Emory Jones plays half the snaps, this is what's going to happen anytime Emory Jones is directing a drive for Florida on Saturday. It's either at best going to be a punt and at worst going to be a turnover. I mean, I have no faith that Emory Jones can do really anything against Georgia's defense. I don't have a ton of confidence that Richardson can, but Richardson is at least super athletic and I think presents problems even for a great defense. Because of what you guys talked about, he can do things above the X's and O's that look to be rare.
Has there ever been a quarterback controversy this discussed in Gainesville?
Well, all the time. The Spurrier ones were all, but you always knew that Spurrier knew what to do. You always knew, even though the national media loved to rip Spurrier, they said he wasn't fair, he yanked his quarterbacks, but we all knew he was getting it right. We all knew when he pulled Terry Dean for Danny Werfel, he was getting it right. We all knew when he picked Shane Matthews over Kyle Morris, he was getting it right. We all knew when he picked Rex Grossman over Brock Berland, he was getting it. Don't you agree with that, Hayes? We all kind of
yes.
knew. We knew he was getting it right because he was Steve Spurrier. So there were a lot of those. Jesse Palmer, Doug Johnson, it was hard to get that one right because neither one of them, they both struggled. So
don't you talk poorly about Jesse Palmer.
But I'm just saying, so we all kind of knew. And I guess, and look, I get this. I get that. Emory Jones, I said this to you, Hayes, at the beginning of the year. By all accounts, everybody I talk to and that I know down there, everybody I'm around, apparently the creme de la creme in good people and hard workers and patient and waited his turn and helped recruit players and is a good teammate to the other quarterbacks and everything you possibly could want in a guy. Emory Jones is all of that. everything you possibly could want in a player. The way he carries himself, the way he carries his classwork, the way he leads in the locker room. And Hayes, I get to where it's hard to move on from that guy. And that's why I've harped to you throughout the early part of this year. But at this point, you're almost doing him a disservice because you don't want other players to resent the fact that he's in there, even though it's not his fault. Every player by now knows they're better with Richardson playing. We've all seen it. The evidence is there now. I guess that's my point. I think Anthony Richardson's going to start the game, and barring injury, will play almost all of the game. That's what I think's going to happen. Not about what I want to happen, which it is, by the way. Hayes, I think Anthony Richardson will start the game. Dan's been coy because you got to be coy. I think Emory could come in for a series or a few plays, but I think it's Anthony Richardson's game. Not Hayes because I want it to be, but because I think that's what Dan Mullen will do.
It's what I think he's going to do as well. I think Richardson starts. I think he's going to handle at least the first two series, if not three. I do think you'll see Emory Jones. And look, I think there can be some benefit in having Anthony Richardson and it being his first start in such an environment. Look, come off to the side. We want to throw Emory Jones at them now. They're a little off balanced. We want to see if Emory can hit a thing or two here. I think there is some merit to that. You know, I mean, just like I thought there was merit to it last year when they would take Trask out. I didn't think they should just abandon that. I mean, I get that there's some value in that. But other than just to sprinkle him in to give Georgia another look, to allow Anthony to have a little bit of a conversation and let Dan say, okay, do you see this? This is what, you know, when you go back in, we're going to do something off of that. I have no problem with that. But if Florida runs 80 plays in this game, 70 of those plays need to be with Anthony Richardson at quarterback.
And I believe they will be. So we'll see if that happens. All right, that'll do it for our program. Tomorrow, live from Dome Hats. Really looking forward to that. Our friends at Dome Hats, real good supporters of this program. Good dudes. Love seeing Jeff and Chris having a Dome Hats happy hour.
That's right. Good to see tomorrow. Jeff and Chris and Jen and Jenny and all of our friends at Dome on 3rd Street. Come see us at 3 to 6 is the show, and 5 to 7 is the Hat Bar happy hour.
Florida, Georgia happy hour. At Dome on a Thursday. That's our program, folks. We'll see you tomorrow. For Hayes, Lauren, and Gibby, I'm Frank Franchi. So long.
Go Braves.